Hello and welcome to the Business of Sustainability podcast, the latest show in partnership with Future Plus and City AM. My name is Mike Penrose and I'm joined by my co-host and fellow founder of Future Plus, Alex Smith. I'm very excited to introduce our very special guest speaker for today's show. He's an award-winning comic, a podcaster, a business speaker, and our staff are particular fans. Stuart Goldsmith, welcome to the show. And could you tell us a little bit about who you are, what you do, and what is sustainable comedy?
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Lovely to be here. I am a stand-up comic, and I guess the headlines are that I've been a podcaster, an interviewer of other comedians for the last 12 years, a stand-up for about 20. And I have gradually realised over those last few years that I'm really interested in trying to help. So in comedy, we say that the problems are the material. So anytime any comedian, when you see their act, they're always wrestling with something. That's the stuff. That's where you get the comedy juice out of it. So I've always written shows based on the problems, the things that I'm struggling with. So that might be parenting young children or my own chronic anxiety, whatever it is. And a couple of years ago, I started to realise that the biggest problem I was faced with was my own burgeoning eco-dread. I knew a little bit about the climate, a little bit about sustainability, but just kind of layperson level. And I started to feel like no one's talking about this. And I mean, obviously, some people in the sustainability world are talking about it, but I wasn't having conversations with any of my friends. And I started to feel like maybe I've gone mad because I'm sort of worrying about it a lot and then just chatting about other stuff. And I thought, well, probably other people are in that position as well. I started writing a show which went on to be a success at the Edinburgh Festival last year. It was one of the top 50 best-reviewed comedy shows, and it was called Spoilers. And it was basically me trying to engage with my climate dread. Now, because I'm a business speaker about what comedy can teach people about resilience, I've been doing that for about 5 years, I recognise that there is probably a way to help leveraging both my comedy expertise and my understanding of the business world. And so I realised I could do something more useful than just make people in a comedy club laugh. I don't have an enormous profile as a comic. I don't have a Netflix special or a million followers on Instagram. But I thought something that I could do that's really useful is that I could go into organisations of all sizes, charities and big corporate organisations, and sort of brief with their sustainability people, their CSR lead or whoever, and then try and recharge their climate messaging with my stand-up comedy.
Fabulous. Alex. First question over to you.
Yeah, the show at the Fringe. Yeah. I will say it was the talk of our office.
Last summer.
As Mike mentioned, you know, Molly came to see you, who works with us at the Fringe, yes. And came back with really empowered and pleased.
That's
so pleased. And I think when you work in sustainability,
yes.
It isn't always, we try to be very positive. We talk about ambition and future and change, mm-hmm. and we talk to people about this all the time. But we also read a lot of research and mm-hmm. we talk to a lot of people about where things aren't going very well. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that Molly came back from, and Ellen has since been to your shows, we've all kind of, you know, I think we can all count ourselves as fans now and have all sort of engaged in different ways, is that there is a positivity around talking about it and making it lighthearted and funny, which yeah. I think is part, you know, such an important part of the show, which I don't always think maybe sustainability professionals
yes.
have managed to bring to the party.
Yes.
So how does that work for you? Where do you bring it all together and how do you get those to that two relationships of something that people have dread
yeah.
and then funny and actually make it into something?
Thank you. That's lovely. I'm really pleased to hear that. And I think that's a really fascinating question because I think for me, I hear that sort of thing a lot, that sustainability professionals, who I now mix with in various odd capacities, I find that because people are often part of existing structures, they can't really say what they really mean. They can't really say the unsayable. People can't go into work as the sustainability lead for a big corporate and go, why isn't anyone listening to me? You can't do that because you're existing within a sort of professional context. As a comedian, I'm allowed to, celebrated for, saying the unsayable. So what I've tried to do is go, what is my route into this? How can I do or say something useful? And what I find time and time again is that people who come to the show or people who see it in a business context, it's almost like they breathe a sigh of relief. They're like, oh, thank God, yes. One of the things I talk about in the show at some length, I kind of come back to this metaphor of feeling like you're falling down a well. Like whenever I see a new news story or a new climate fact, anything on a newspaper front page, I think, oh, my God. And it kicks me down the well and I fall down this sort of well in my mind until I'm sat at the bottom feeling dejected and lonely and having all these like selfish thoughts, feeling really ashamed of how selfish I'm thinking. How can I protect my family and, you know, it's not everyone else. And I don't think that the tools to fight the climate crisis are at the bottom of a well. Yeah. So I think we all have to climb back up out of it. But there's not really often a place in a corporate environment, in a sort of professional sustainability environment, to say, Jesus, I feel terrible today. I'm completely freaking out. And I just want to hold hands and know that someone else feels like that. The thing I hear over and over again is that people go to work in their sustainability profession and they relate to other people there. This is worrying. Oh, my God, have you seen this? This is terrifying. And then they go home or they go to the pub and no one's talking about it. And they start to feel like they've gone crazy. They start to feel like, is this real? Am I inventing it? And so actually giving people a bit of a pressure release valve to say, we are all terrified. Let's all, not hold hands in a kind of happy, clappy kind of a way, but let's just accept. This is the magical thing about comedy. When someone says something and they nail it, they say something. In observational comedy, the point is to try and say something that everyone has noticed, but that they haven't noticed that they've noticed. And that is an incredibly powerful thing. You think of Mickey Flanagan's out-out routine. Yeah. That just exploded because people went, oh, I do that. And it's obvious that I do that, but I've never articulated it. If I can help to do that with some things in sustainability, then people can go, oh, of course, we're all thinking like that. Then I think we'll all feel a bit more motivated and capable mentally of climbing out the well.
I think one thing I'm really interested in your perspective on the role humour plays in motivating people to make change, because I've noticed a lot in from our staff, amongst our clients, when things get scary, people get very serious about stuff. And as we were talking about earlier, and as our listeners will know, I spent 26 years as a humanitarian aid worker in conflict areas. And the worst humour, the most inappropriate, darkest humour, are people who spend their time in the most difficult circumstances. It becomes almost a coping mechanism. The way that they can come to terms with some of the most awful things is to make really, really inappropriate jokes about it. Sure. But for me, that almost... It allows people to have the debates that are needed. And how have you found that humour has helped introduce the concepts that people actually need to talk about?
Thank you. I think that there can be a release in kind of gallows humour, definitely. I think the danger is that a lot of the stand-up comedy that I see that refers in passing to the climate crisis, it's a sort of a, can I swear on this podcast? I probably can't, can I? Sure. It's a sort of a, ha ha ha, aren't we all fucked? Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And there is a value to that. There is a reassuring value. There is a communality to saying, oh my God, I'm terrified, you're terrified too. But it's very hard to wield comedy to do something positive because it becomes suspect. As soon as you start using comedy to try to do something, there's the danger it turns into like Christian rock music. Do you know what I mean? You sort of go, this has an overt agenda and it's no longer the thing. So for me, I'm really interested in walking that tightrope between not just going, ha ha, aren't we all fucked? But and equally not going, come on, guys, we can do it. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. But I think in between, in the space in between those things is a really interesting, really funny, really useful sort of an area.
I agree entirely. Alex will know, I have a penchant for slightly ironic T-shirts in the office. And I have one that's given to me because I like rock music a great deal that says, ride bikes, eat vegetables, be nice, hail Satan.
Yeah, yeah, great.
And
yeah.
I think, you know, that type of thing, again, interesting.
Yes,
it makes people laugh.
That's lovely. And that is exactly, that's right along that line, isn't it? Because it's not just stuff everything, but nor is it, hooray, everything's going to be fine. And I think one of the things I wrestled with in the creation of this show and the other material I've got is that I sort of thought, oh my God, am I going to end up being like a shill for the climate crisis because I'm just making everyone feel okay about it? And actually, if the role of comedy is to release pressure, maybe we need that pressure. Maybe it doesn't need to be released. Maybe it needs to turn into anger and protest and activism. But I do. So I've been conflicted by that notion quite a lot. But I think where I've come to with that is that it's the sort of pressure release of saying, look, you can do this, of pick yourself up and go for it. I think you can. I went to just before Just Stop Oil first threw soup on a painting and got famous. I went to, and I'm not a member of that organization, but I'm sort of adjacent. I've been on an Extinction Rebellion march. I've dipped my toe in a bit. I went to one of their meetings, and something that really struck me, they said, in order to help, you don't need to go and get, you don't need to glue yourself to something. We also need people to collect people who've glued themselves to something and been arrested and then been de-arrested, we need people to go and look after them and bring them home. So there are lots of different ways to help besides taking really extreme action. And I think that that parallel, you can apply that to a lot of things. So I think trying to come up with comedy as a way that sort of innovates and invigorates and makes people feel good. And also, I mean, the thing I say to my to kind of corporate clients, if I'm briefing with them, the thing I say to sustainability leads is, what would you say to your CEO if you could slam him against a wall and go, will you bloody listen? Tell me that, and I'll write jokes about that, and I'll sneak it in. Yeah.
Do you get pushback? I mean, there's like Just Stop Oil, Extinction Rebellion, going in and speaking to CEOs and slapping them around the face with a wet fish and saying this fish needs better life. All of those things. Do you find that when you're touring, and is it, do you get any pushback? And if you get pushback, is it from particular audiences? Well,
there's two things. I'll talk about audiences in a second. I'll come back to that. Broadly speaking, and I think this is, I don't know if this is unique to me or what. I didn't start doing stand-up for years after I wanted to start doing stand-up because I was scared of being heckled. The idea of pushback of one sort, the idea, I basically, my internal heckler prevented me from getting 15 years experience I could have. So I was really scared of that. When I started talking about climate, I was really scared of getting pushback. I thought, oh my God, I'm not going to be activist enough for the activists. I'm not going to be business enough for the business people. And actually what I find is, and this may be because part of what I think, it's almost like part of one of the ways in which I'm useful is I look nice and I sound nice and I get on with everyone. My first review, it was a dagger in my heart. My first ever comedy review 20 years ago said, when this guy walks on the stage, you just think everything's going to be all right. And I was like, no, I want to be Bill Hicks. I want to be tearing up, you know. No, in comedy, you can only be who you really are. And I do have some quality that makes people go, oh, well, listen to this guy. I trust him. It's a good job I'm not a politician because I think I'd be good at it, but also terrible at it. So I think that maybe for me, I am particularly, or maybe I'm just a bit too timid and I don't, you know, I'm not a big social media warrior. I don't argue with people. I don't think anything comes of that. I've never changed my opinion about after seeing an argument online. So that kind of pushback, and I suppose the point I'm making is, if anyone else is thinking, what's my climate side hustle? What can I do to start helping? The message would be, don't turn the idea of pushback into this big spectre that stops you doing something helpful. Having said that, yes, in the year and a half I took in comedy clubs all over the country building the show, there were certainly moments where audiences, it was more, the pushback was less into, I mean, there were some walkouts. There were some, a grumbly couple in Bradford upon Avon left and said, he's a preacher. We didn't come here to be preached at. But to be fair to them, the mic had broken. And so I was at the end of a bill. Basically, it was an early point in the show and it was me screaming statistics and fear. So I feel bad for them. There were, worse than heckles, there was disinterest. When I first started, I thought I was going to come on stage. I mean, I'm a very experienced comic. I'm very good at making big crowds of people laugh a lot. And I would come on stage and I thought, I'll go on and I'll go, hey, you know you're terrified about the climate. And the audience would basically go, yeah. And I'd do some jokes. But what happened is I'd go, you know you're terrified of the climate. And the audience would go, no, not really. Is there a problem? Or they'd go, well, I mean, yeah, but I don't want to think about this now. I've got a babysitter and I deserve a night out. And they do. So that sort of, not exactly pushback, but clag, like swamp to kind of drag yourself through. As a result of that, the material has become quite robust because I've had to learn to go, I had to learn how to frame it, to go, look, I'm not a scientist, I'm not an activist, and crucially, I'm not here to be holier than thou, to tell you, you need to live my life. You know, I'm not a vegan, I still fly, I'm trying, you know, but I'm not going out there saying, wag finger, you've got to, you know, raise yourself up to my level, because I think that doesn't work. I've had people do that to me and gone, oh, I don't want to be a vegan now.
I think it's a really interesting one that you're mentioning there again about the positivity of the messaging and things like this. One of the biggest debates we're having in the office, you know, starting with the negative, some of the stats coming out at the moment are, you know, 40 to 50% of all young men reject feminism now because they feel they can't talk about it and they're isolated. And there was a big survey done across the EU. It's really quite terrifying. The huge number of companies now are pushing back on climate change because they feel it's too much of a burden on them. But the positive side, and I did, when I was working with a big not-for-profit, we did a big piece of, a big survey, a big study that showed that if you go to somebody and try and elicit a sympathy or anger, mm-hmm. you know, here's a starving child or the planet's burning, mm-hmm. they'll give you £10, but they're giving you £10 to go away.
Yes.
They don't want it
yes,
to be part
of
their life.
Ignore this tax. Yeah.
If you create a sense of empathy or humour or something about it, they'll give you less money immediately, but they'll keep coming back. And we translated that through to, I sort of helped reinvigorate and bring to the fore Soccer Aid, was the chairman of Soccer Aid for a long time. And the premise of that was very similar to what you were saying there. People watch most telethons and charity things because they feel they should out of a sense of duty. People watch Soccer Aid because they want to watch the bloke from Love Island tackle a Premiership footballer alongside Usain Bolt with Rita Ora singing at halftime in a sport that they love, because sport's part of who they are. And I find humour sort of identifies so much with people. Totally. When you're going into boardrooms and with staff, and you're dealing with things that are quite existential to business and that people are actually worried about from a livelihood perspective, how do you flip that? How do you get the CEO aligned with the worker who probably have the same concern but coming at it from different angles?
Yeah, thanks. I mean, a great question. And I absolutely take your point about something like Soccer Aid. I think that, yeah, it's all very well asking people to come and support a thing. I was an actor for a while. God, I got sick of saying, hey, can you come and see my show, Brackets, to do me a favour? Whereas now, I always forget to invite friends and relatives. My mum's always like, oh, I see you're near, weren't you going to tell us? Because I just hate the idea of having to go, do me a favour by watching. It should be good. It should be so good, exactly like that people go, oh, I've opted into this because I want to. So in terms of going into those kind of environments, how do I try to get the message across? I suppose that the thing that I'll use anything I can. I can never attribute this quote, but someone said, what do we do about the climate crisis? And the answer is everything. We do everything. So I have to remind myself, I personally don't have to solve this. I personally don't have to convince this one CEO to radically change their thing. I'm just trying to help. I'm trying to help the sustainability person be more understood, get their message heard. And a lot of the time, all that department wants is, we want the rest of the company to know that we exist. And we want them to feel good about us. We want them to think that we're cool and we're fun and they can come to us. And that might be a way that I can help. I also think that I did loads and loads of Zoom interviews with corporate sustainability professionals while I was writing the show. And something that someone said really stuck with me, a guy who works for an investment bank in the States, he said, the good thing about the climate is that capital has decided it's real. Now, I don't know the numbers. I don't know the stats on, I mean, it terrifies me, the idea of 50% of young men are rejecting feminism. I don't know the stats and the numbers on the climate and which banks are operating how. But I think it was in the context of the possibility of another Trump presidency. And he was saying, look, whoever is in charge, business knows. If you're an actuary, if you're adjusting for loss and risk and what have you, you can't pretend it's not real. It's insane. And business has understood that. It will obviously, what we need is a screeching handbrake. Mm-hmm. And we're not going to get a screeching handbrake. And that's going to be catastrophic, but not the absolute end of all human life. So what we need are ways in which people, in which organization, in which individuals, I suppose, can recognize this is going to take some time, but it has to change. We're turning every battleship, what's the phrase, turning a tanker. Yeah, yeah. We're turning all the tankers. And it's not going to happen tomorrow. And you can't let that make you sort of disillusioned and go, oh, there's no point.
I think that's a really, really important one, just to say, because the feminism quote, and that was a study that came out, is linked to all of these things, where I think if you go into people and create a polarizing debate, you're not doing enough, you should do it quicker, you should feel bad about it, you should change your life tomorrow, you should be doing this, you should be doing that, and you shut them down when they say, I'm afraid, I'm worried, what does this mean for me? What are the implications for my life? And they're not allowed to talk about that. You know, it's why after Obama we got Trump. It's why after Cool Britannia we got Brexit.
Sure.
You know, when you create you create an elite sort of debate that it sits within one constituency and polarizes from another. You said earlier on, you know, you've never been convinced by watching an argument online. Mm-hmm. Same thing happens. They look at that debate and go, well, if you're not interested in my opinion, then I'm joining the other side.
Yeah.
And I think humor's ability to not trivialize it, but lighten it to such an extent that maybe they can say a joke about it. Maybe
absolutely. There are certain parts of my political system which were grown by watching the Mark Thomas comedy product or the Mark Thomas comedy show when I was, I could never vote conservative because I've watched loads of Mark Thomas. Yeah. And I think there are situations in which There are jokes that I think of other people's, that every time I do a thing, every time I shower, I think of a Seinfeld bit, every time I go on holiday, I think whatever. If I can write jokes, and I can't promise I've done this, but this is my aspiration. If I can write a joke that every time someone's about to take an action, some sort of negative action, whether it's remembering their reusable cup or declining a disposable one, or the fact that most compostable coffee cups are only compostable if they undergo a special industrial composting process, which they're not going to because we just put them in the bin. We go, fine, it's compostable. You know, if I can write a joke about that, and similarly, if I can write a joke that helps to turn a tanker, and maybe someone with their hands on the levers of genuine power is about to do a thing and goes, I just can't get that funny idea out of my head. Maybe that could be useful. I think we both cut you off, Alex.
No. Well, you know, you were talking about feminism, so I didn't want to jump in.
Two white men.
I thought I'd just let you flow.
Let me fall on my sword.
Welcome to my world.
I was just going to say, I think what we are trying to do in a much less funny way, so I think we could actually learn quite a lot from what you do, is very much that. And it's giving accountability to people in their roles to say, look, this is something you can do something about. It's not going to be the be all and end all. You aren't going to fix this problem. But if you just understand it a little bit more, if you understand what the decision is that you're choosing. So, you know, we talk about understanding social impact with environmental impact and understanding both of that. But I think, I think it's probably a lot that we could learn about bringing in a lightness to that, as well as the seriousness because we are in corporate situations going in and saying, yes. You know, accounts do this, HR, you should look at that. Have you thought about this? Ooh, procurement. Ooh, Christ. Mm-hmm. You want to buy those compostable coffee cups? Sure. How are you going to communicate that? Because that's a complicated message to go out. And I think having that knowledge and being able to lighten it is probably the way forward for most of us to go through.
So something I think about a lot is there's a quote from Dr. Sandra Steingraber, the Save the World Symphony. Do you know this quote? Yeah. It's our duty now to play the Save the World Symphony. You don't have to play a solo, but you do have to know what instrument you're playing. So I think, and not only do I totally agree with that and find it incredibly energizing, but also that's like, oh, it'd be even better if that was funny. Do you know what I mean? It'd be even stickier if it was funny. Or maybe it would be, it's perfectly fine as it is, but maybe I can write some funny ones, you know. So trying to find ways that that do that, that remind people of those positives and their those possibilities, I think is really important, yeah.
And without creating a spoiler for spoilers,
yeah.
As part of it, you look at climate confessions.
Yes.
And you pick. Is that
it's
the right
my favourite
word?
Bit. I wish I could do a whole hour of it. I absolutely love it. I solicit climate confessions. So I kind of create a space in the show at two different points to say to the crowd, let's just share, let's drag some of our kind of negative climate behaviour into the light. Because, again, I think that's one of the reasons if people feel berated or caught out. You know, if you say to someone, if you say to me, if you go, well, what are you doing about so-and-so? My natural reaction is going to be, I have to defend myself. I'm being attacked and I'm going to defend. So I try to sort of turn that on its head and go, let's all share the horrible, grubby stuff we do. Not to celebrate it at all, but to kind of, we applaud each other for having the kind of the bravery to confess. So some of the things that will come up were, I mean, one of mine that I used for a while to kind of get the ball rolling was that, this is a bit long, I'll try and shorten it. I made a commitment at Edinburgh 2 years ago, at the Edinburgh Festival. I go every year, I've been nearly 30 years. I said, right, that's it, no more disposable cups. Compostable, whatever, doesn't matter, no more disposable cups. I lost my reusable cup just before I went on stage. And I was like, God, I've got to go on stage in 10 minutes. I'll run over the road to the coffee place and can I take a crockery one and take it with me? They said, it's not our policy, you're not allowed. I said, oh God, all right, then I'll break. This is like day four. I've done so well for 4 days. I got the coffee in a reusable thing. I was like, the people need my jokes. I need the caffeine for the jokes. I ran back, got backstage, found my reusable cup 2 minutes before going on and went, and poured it in. Dreadful, dreadful. I felt bad. You know, it was sort of kind of jokey, but also a confession. So I get the ball rolling like that, and we go one at a time, and we ask people. I have had some absolute killers. There was a guy from Oklahoma in the front row of the crowd who said his confession was that he took the catalytic converter off his car to make it sound better. Painful. Another favorite was someone, a friend of mine actually, who said that during the heat wave 2 years ago, he got in the habit of showering in his Speedos and then walking dripping wet to his car and sitting in it with the engine on and the aircon running. Like, awful, awful. And there is, because I can kind of, I have
most
nice guy stuff.
people.
I mean, they are. But this is the problem. The worst thing is you can see some people going, great idea. Yeah. Absolutely don't do that. But I like to, you know, it's a good way of kind of zhuzhing up an audience and breaking the ice and establishing. I think that's, for me, the key thing it does is it establishes that none of us are perfect. And it also, every so often, there'll be something like, I did a degree in environmental science and now I work for a fossil fuel company. And you can hear everyone go, ooh. And we can jump on that and go, what is it about that that's annoyed you all so much? Because that isn't the worst. And I mean, it's not great, but it's not the worst. And it's the hypocrisy. And we can have a conversation about the hypocrisy and why it kind of jazzes us so much. So given that we're on the subject, would you like to share a climate confession with me?
I'll go first. Feel free.
I think mine is, whilst I know one of the biggest contributors to climate change is meat and the amount of meat we eat. I have a son who is in the academy of a professional rugby team. I'm the under-18s of a professional rugby team.
And you're going to eat him?
And yes, and I ate him. I already have. He consumes. He is obsessed with having as much meat as he possibly can, and I give in every single time. So he's on 3,500 calories a day, about half of that. He's the size of a brick outhouse. He's very large, very muscular, very quick, and eats possibly a couple of tons of carbon of meat a day.
Yes, you've got to start grinding up insect protein into his body.
It is in time. No, I have started using more sustainable meat, and so I found a really good one. Rabbit apparently is much lower carbon footprint than chicken. Yeah. But I just keep making him rabbit casserole and telling him it's chicken.
Nice.
So
carbon footprint pet. Recently in a report.
It's what the lightest,
the lowest
carbon
footprint for a pet.
Yeah, apparently from what it eats to how quickly it grows, to how you can farm it. Apparently rabbit is really low carbon, and because I live down the road from Borough Market, I've taken to buying rabbit and passing it off as chicken, although I understand he does like to listen to me on the radio, so sorry, Tom, you've been eating rabbit.
Oh, wow, that's why I never score. Yeah, great. Thank you.
Oh, gosh, mine. I think there's the obvious, like you say, the coffee cups. There is the full knowledge that I should never have a coffee cup, but we have all forgotten our reusable cups. And you know, flying, I do fly, but I truly believe that you should fly and see other places, otherwise you can't appreciate what you need. But I think, actually, not dissimilar, the form of most of my guilt in my life, climate or otherwise, is probably my children. And I would say that they have not got the memo about climate change. They are teenage boys, and I am that person who's like, but you don't understand, you shouldn't buy things from X because it's not sustainable. Or you know, of course you shouldn't ship that in from China. Have you thought about buying this t-shirt with no branding on that's far more ethical and sustainable? So they have not got the memo, and I appreciate that that may come later in life, but I feel like for the length of time that I've been going on about it, maybe that is why.
Maybe
I need a better way of humor.
I've got the other end of that problem in that my children are 5 and 8 and they pick me up on it, which is great. I've created a rock for my back here whereby I'm going to live what I think is as sustainably as possible, and it's never going to be good enough for them.
But it's coming. My son, when I was younger, used to lecture me, and then he hit peak teen, and then all of a sudden it was Nike clothes and I like rugby, and the lecturing went out the window and the demands of dad, can you just buy me this?
Yes, it is tricky. It is a conflict that all of us are going to face for the rest of our lives. How do we manage what we want to do and what we constitute? I mean, one of the biggest challenges I had for one of the shows I did for a sustainability group is they were a consultancy, and they said our biggest I said, you know, I'll write jokes about your challenges. Tell me your challenges. And they were German. They were very German. They sent me a PDF of 30 challenges like 6 hours later. And it was all about their consultants, and their consultants fly everywhere, and their consultants fly business class everywhere, which, as you know, is 3 times worse for your carbon emissions. And
confessions. I have in the past flown business class.
Economy, it's a conversation we have.
Very good, very good.
It is, but I would argue I had a deep vein thrombosis from flying too much. So that is
no defence.
I know, but I'm still sticking to it.
So they said all of our consultants regard themselves as elites who deserve prestige and who deserve business class. And so I wrote some jokes about that, but I think one of the ideas from that is what other ways can we find to create a feeling of prestige? Because to prestige ourselves to death, that's so, God, it's so pointless, you know. But given how arbitrary it is, the things that we consider meaningful in terms of, well, I deserve this because I deserve a treat. You know, and I don't, you know, I feel I deserve treats. I don't treat myself all the time. But yeah, I think it's, you know, it's going to be a conflict for the rest of our lives. How do we do the right thing? You know, there's 500,000 people in the air right now. I don't think that we can meaningfully say to people, the solution is we just convince everyone to not fly anymore. It's not going to work on an individual level. So,
but I think that, and this leads up into a really interesting thing that it sort of underpins what we've tried to do as a business. And the flying one, we talk very much about the green bean conundrum. The way that life is today is that if you are running a restaurant, you want to buy green beans, and you want to have a really high social impact. We know some great providers by the edge of Lake Naivasha in Kenya that they put their profits back into educating young girls. They pay for the local education systems. They put it all back into the community. It's a real social enterprise. But if you're buying beans from Lake Naivasha in Kenya, they're going to have a high carbon footprint. If you want low carbon footprint, we know some great providers in the Cotswolds who'll grow them. And it's got a really low carbon footprint, but the only social impact you'll have is putting Tamara and Tarquin's kid through private school. Mm. So sometimes you do have to balance between do you want high social, low carbon, or vice versa. And it sort of leads into one of the things we find difficult to push back on, because people do respond to icons, are all these sort of badges of sustainability that exist out there at the moment. You know, I'm a so-and-so. Because what we find is that we provide a very balanced, transparent, as Alex said, we don't tell people if they are good or bad. We just tell them where they are and where they want to be and allow them to be positive in communicating that. What we found with these badges is that people work really hard to get them. And then when they've got them, they believe they're elite. So they stop. Yeah. And maybe every 3 years they'll do a dash to the sprint to get recertified. But it doesn't incentivize that constant change. And I think, you know, that struck me when you said they believe themselves to elite. Creating a new sense of the elite around being transparent. I know where I am. And it might not be good, but I know where I want to be. Yeah. And that's something positive. And allowing the narrative to be focused on change as opposed to just validating past behaviour.
Yes. Yes. No, I mean, I don't know what the solution is. I think it's a really good point. I think that's very, very difficult as people start to... I mean, the thing that happened to me at the festival is other comics started sidling up to me and going, are we really screwed? And I was like, oh, big answer. Depends who you mean by we. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah, there's a lot, there's a tremendous amount. We'll be okay the longest, yeah. Kind of, you know, but not okay. So, yes, as the Overton windows to do with various behaviour and what's acceptable as they shift, I suppose in my heart I'm kind of an optimist. I don't sort of often say that out loud, but I do think that we have to be moving in the right direction. And obviously optimism is a privilege, just as doomerism is a privilege, you know. But I think that we have to start recognizing, as people's homes start falling into the sea and as some of those really challenging things happen, when we have... God knows, food wars in 2040 or whatever it is, you know, when those things start to happen more and more, I hope that almost the benefit of how fast, how exponential the I'm not going to use the word collapse, that's a doom word, but when things continue to get worse, but exponentially faster, hopefully the upside to that, the small upside, will be that the speed of that means that we don't have that chilling effect where we go, well, it's always like this. You know, I grew up in a world in which the barrier reef is in danger. So I'm used to the barrier reef being in danger, and my children will grow up in a world where the barrier reef is kind of bleached. So they're used to that. So maybe one upside of the speed of how difficult things are is that people won't get used to it, that everyone will go. But there's another whole other question about, we talked a little bit about young people, my kids, your teenagers, and the extent to which they are motivated, and
which is reducing
because the messaging they're getting is, it's up to you now, guys. Yeah. The boomer generation, we had everything, no war in a lot of places, and we just made all this money, and now we've smashed it. Sorry, I'm just going to go and die now. And then, you know, the frustration, how can we mediate that? How can we turn that into a positive message?
We had a conversation, and we've probably got to sort of close up now. We had a conversation in the office, which I think really sums this up nicely, is everyone sort of said why they were there. It was probably about six, eight months ago. And I think what came through is we're all there because we believe there is still optimism and hope. So if we can convince people and create a ripple effect of what they could do, and then they go and convince other people about what they could do, then we're moving in the right direction. And at least we're going out with a bit of a fight.
going out with a fighting arrow. That sounds inherently bad.
Yeah.
We are going down fighting.
Down nonetheless. I think we've got a bit of a loot. We've got a bit of a down, and hopefully it will come back up. But I mean, at least if we're there and having that conversation and giving people the tools and the comedy and the humour and the knowledge and the vocabulary to talk about it, then at least we're there.
Well, on that cheery note from Alex.
That's my fault. I imposed that on you. I'm so sorry.
That's all we got time for. But a huge thank you, Stuart, for joining us today.
Thanks
for all that contribution. And we'll definitely be coming to see your next show.
Thank you.
But if you'd like to join the conversation, please leave us a comment or question in the comments section or email us at info@future-plus.co.uk. And please remember to hit the subscribe button for future episodes. And if you'd like to find out more about Future Plus or to keep up to date with Stuart, please visit the links in the description.